Welcome, everyone, to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast. I'm Amy Hall, and Greg Kokel is here with me today, every day.
We haven't had a guest appearance in a long time by somebody else, so...
That's right.
Wait until we get to May or June.
When you go on vacation.
Yeah.
All right, so let's start with a question from Sarah. If God is a fundamental truth, why isn't knowledge of him accessible to all of his creation, human beings? Is there sufficient evidence / knowledge to conclude that God does exist?
Well, this question is a little bit vague to me, or ambiguous. I'm not sure what she means by God as a fundamental truth. Everything that's true, no one thing that's true is more true than another. Truth isn't a degreed property, you know. I mean, I guess if an article could have more truths in it than some other article, but that's the article. Any particular truth is either true or false. It's an on or off switch. So now what she might think is a necessary truth, that that there is no possible world where God cannot exist. But that's a deliberation of philosophy, and a lot of people are not in a position to make those kinds of deliberations to determine that if God exists, he exists necessarily, all right? So, and some don't even know what that means. And frankly, I'm in the cloud somewhat about that whole argument. So I'm sympathetic there. If she's just saying if God is really there, then why isn't there sufficient information? Of course, our view is there is sufficient information. And this is part of the argument of Paul in Romans chapter 1. There's sufficient information in the natural realm for people to know there's God. But the reason that they don't acknowledge God is because they're suppressing the truth, which is obvious, in unrighteousness. That's a famous passage in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, and following that whole passage. If you go into chapter 2, he says there's evidence in the moral law that when people are judging other people and don't keep the law themselves, whatever law it is that they're judging on, that shows that there is a law written in their heart, and it is also showing they don't keep it. So they are just as without excuse as those people in chapter 1 that have the evidence of God right before their eyes, but choose to worship the creature rather than the creator. So In my estimation, from a biblical perspective, there's plenty of evidence. Now, there is a thing called, some people refer to as the hiddenness of God, and Christians might reference that, and it's that why isn't God more obvious than he seems to be? And I was just pausing, trying to think of a metaphor to illustrate this distinction, and I guess the metaphor could be, you could go to somebody's house and go in the house and see this is clearly a house that is lived in. It all has all the evidences not only of occupancy but of recent occupancy. There's been activity here. There's grease on the counter and kitchen dishes in the sink, and the coffee cup is still a little bit warm from the morning's coffee, blah, 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 blah. So you know there's activity, but you don't see the person. And so there's a certain sense that what Romans 1 and Romans 2 are referring to is the house that's occupied. But that doesn't mean that you always see the person moving about. And I think this is a common complaint of Christians. Where is God when? And I'll tell you, in my own life, I think back, and when I was newly a Christian, the first 3 or 4 years of my Christian life, and God seemed to show up a whole lot more than he has since then. And I've heard mature Christians make the same observation. So that, and I'm not sure, one fairly well-known writer made the comment that the older I get in Christ, the further he seems away from me. It's a very odd situation, because one would think that the older you get, the more mature you get, and the more close you get. And that seems to belie a lot of popular claims that relationship with God is like a love affair. you know, and we are just going deeper and deeper in passionate love with God. I never cared for that characterization, but a lot of people in popular writing characterize this kind of a divine romance that way. And well, it certainly has not been the case for me. And if anyone fancies that my life has been somewhat useful in the kingdom, that does not characterize my interior life. So I do think that there is this element where we can often ask, where is God? You know, where is he? I don't see him showing up. I come to the house and there's always no one home kind of thing, you know, back to that house analogy. Incidentally, just to jump back to the evidence issue, there are lots of atheists that say there's no evidence for God. Now, this is extremely self-serving. Now, whether the evidence is convincing to them is another issue, but there is plenty of evidence that is matter that people can present that weighs in on behalf of God's existence. There's tons of it. Now, if an atheist doesn't think it's persuasive, fine, but it's just not fair for him to say there's no evidence. However, this was the charge of the famous 20th century philosophical atheist, British Bertrand Russell. And he says, no evidence. And he said, what would happen if you died and you went and saw God? I would say, God, why didn't you give us more evidence? So, you know, that's what they say. And maybe that's what the concern is here. I do remember reading his book on Why I'm Not a Christian, which is really subpar considering his capability. It's awful. Generally acknowledged to be awful. And one, he says he doesn't think Jesus ever existed historically. Maybe he's a victim of his time with that regard, because so much more information has been produced in the last 30 years or so in that regard. And secondly, he thought Jesus, even if he didn't, he made a big mistake by claiming to be the only way. So this means he did not understand the Christian point of view. There's a reason why Jesus is the only way. He did not understand that. And for the eminent philosopher he was, that surprises me. But in any event, those are the two senses, I think, in which people say there's not enough evidence. And the one, I think they're just wrong. That's the skeptics or atheists' point. There certainly is evidence, plenty of it. And whether it's enough or not depends on individual point of view, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the second one, the hiddenness of God, the concern of the Christian, I'm sympathetic to that. I think it's true. I think God does hide himself for his reasons, even from his own, in terms of a subjective sense, because as Lewis makes the point that he's doing something significant there.
Yeah, in terms of there being sufficient evidence and knowledge to conclude God exists, I think there's a reason why all the cultures across time in all these different places have all had an idea of some sort of idea of the supernatural, some sort of an idea of God, whatever that concept might be. There's uh-huh. always been that. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why that is, like you mentioned in Romans 1, I just wanted to read what it says there in verse 20. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that we see from the things around us, we, even if we're not thinking intelligent design arguments specifically, we can see from around us that we can reason from that something created us. And as far as God being unseen, I would say there's some on God's part of him withdrawing. And we see that even in Romans 1, we see that because people rejected God and they turned to worshiping the creature rather than the creator, God gave them over. So this idea of God giving people over to their rejection of him, I mm-hmm. think is probably on God's part the reason why we don't see him as clearly.
Mm-hmm. That's a good nature. Point. That's a great point. That reminds me of Pharaoh hardening his heart for the first five plagues, and then God hardening Pharaoh's heart for the second five plagues. You know, Pharaoh was already inclined to reject. You know, so there's a certain sense in parallel, God gave him over there. So,
but there's also, so that's on God's part, but also on our part, we're actually hiding from him. And I always think of that. There's a passage in Acts where Paul is talking to Felix, and what it says is, as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, "Go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you." So we actually have fear because of our guilt.
Yeah,
I think that we are also hiding from God. So I think all of these things, where there is reason, just by looking at nature, that we can reason to God and know that he exists. Yeah. And there may even be something more than that. There may be something innate in us that knows that as well.
I agree with that, certainly that last point, and I think that's part of the argument of Romans 1. It also, when Paul's at the Areopagus, I never can remember the chapter, but the—
17, Acts 17.
But he says that he talks about in him, this is his own message there, we live and we move and we have our very being. We exist, as your own poets have said. And I'm looking for— he says he's not very far from us if, in fact, we look.
That's verse 27.
Okay, that God has established the boundaries of human habitation in order that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. So I think there is a human element that's involved, and if we're not looking, we're not going to see. And if we don't want him for whatever our reasons, which would be many, certainly pertaining to sin, then we are not going to look for him. So I have one other thing I wanted to say, though, before we close this question off, and that is many say the reason that God is not more obvious is because he will, if he were more obvious, he would overpower our freedom to believe. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but this strikes me as complete nonsense. This is the, and I'll give you a couple of scriptural reasons why I think that. This is the idea that we want to protect free will so aggressively that we don't want God to do anything that might influence our freedom so much that his presence becomes indubitable, and therefore we can't doubt, and therefore we must believe. And that seems to be an assault on our freedom. Never mind the question about freedom. You know, that aside, even if one has an entirely robust understanding of individual freedom when it comes to this thing, there are plenty of cases in the Bible where people were dead center, straightforward, right there in front of the absolute glory of God that made no difference whatsoever. The obvious one is in John chapter 11 and chapter 12, where Lazarus is raised from the dead after being dead for 3 days, okay? This guy stunk. And that was the complaint about, you know, calling, "Don't open that grave, man. He stinketh," you know, that kind of thing. But it was an unbelievable miracle the week before Jesus was crucified. And it said in the next chapter, because Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, the Jews sought to kill him. And by the way, if they kill Jesus, the evidence of him raising Lazarus from the dead is still walking the face of the earth, i.e. Lazarus himself, and therefore they had to kill Lazarus also. For some reason, it didn't enter their mind if they say kill him a second time, he can raise him a second time. But in any event, there you go. That's unbelievable unbelief. I'm also just now finished the book of Exodus yesterday, and there you have the glory of God appearing in an unbelievable way, with a pillar of fire at night and a cloud by day. Day by day, the Shekinah glory of God always there. And when Moses goes up on Mount Sinai, to talk with God, and he's gone for 40 days, where is the Shekinah glory? It's banging and booming and crashing on the top of Mount Sinai. But the people get tired, and they say, we don't know where this man went. Make us a god, Aaron, and we will worship this golden calf, excuse me, that brought us out of the land of Egypt. So it's like, wait a minute. Where is this guy? He's up there with all that crashing and booming, you know? It didn't make any difference. So God could stand right in front of somebody and punch him in the nose. And, as one wag put it, he said to the atheists who claimed that if God would just appear in front of him, he would go to God. And the Christian said, no, you wouldn't go to God. You'd go to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, we're not so great at at following God as fallen people. And I think we really do underestimate the influence that has on our entire lives, our fallenness.
By the way, you also see that so aggressively when you talk with atheists who, well, you ask them what kind of evidence would be necessary and to convince them. And they give you such bizarre things that are way over the top. And then they qualify and say, and even if that happened, I don't know if I'd be convinced. Oh, duh.
Well, the idea, I mean, you can understand why fallen people would hide from God. God is a very scary concept because we know our guilt. And mm-hmm. even when we won't admit it to ourselves, the idea of, like I just read with Felix, the idea of a being who created us who is going to judge us is very frightening mm-hmm. unless you know grace. Mm-hmm. Grace is the only thing that makes it all right for us to go to him.
That's right. Yeah, Lewis develops the idea of God is a very dangerous being. I mentioned it in the story of reality, and the only safe place for in the presence of a holy God, which is dangerous for unholy people, is at the foot of the cross. Exactly.
Well, let's slip one more question in here. This one comes from Harmony Wheeler. A friend made a lighthearted post with an underlying worldview. Is it appropriate to respond, especially given the post was not serious or direct in nature? I don't have a strong personal relationship with this person and worry about remaining professional.
Okay. So it's a professional environment. If it expresses an underlying worldview, that is their own personal point of view, in a very subtle way, possibly, and maybe in a whimsical way, and it isn't a shot across the bow at Christianity, and it's a professional relationship, I think I would just let it go. Because the person could say, well, I was just kidding. And so it will come across maybe to the other people viewing, especially the person who wrote the post, as being overly critical.
Yeah, I think it's so tricky, and it's hard to evaluate without knowing the entire situation here. It might be possible to ask a question, you know, Columbo style.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious, what do you mean by that? Is that, mm-hmm. is that, you know, maybe there's a friendly way to draw them out without just going after the worldview.
Yeah, or you could say, yeah, it was a clever remark. I got a chuckle out of it, frankly, but it did raise a question in my own mind just out of curiosity. But the thing is, if you word it that way, it just raised a question in my own mind out of curiosity. You have to be very careful in how you respond to the response. Because if then you start going aggressively after worldview, then it looks like you're really raising the issue to pick a fight. Now, what you can do is if you continue with clarifying questions that are really demonstrate your own interest in understanding what the person was getting at, but at the same time, as I've said a lot in the past, by asking those kinds of questions of just help me out here. I'm still trying to figure it out. This gets them, that itself is the stone in their shoe. So you're going to probably have to use Columbo 1, questions for clarification's sake, what do you mean by that, as the thing that will do most of your work in your gardening in that circumstance. Since what you did was express in your response a kind of a casual curiosity and interest in more clarification. You don't want to go after them in an aggressive way because then it'll look like your question was actually disingenuous.
I think the best thing to do would be to bring it up in person. It's hard to tell here if there's any
That's
relationship.
That's not legal in the state of California. Just saying.
It's hard to tell if this is only an online relationship. If it's not, then I would just bring it up in person. I think a lot of times we're too afraid to talk about things in person, but I think it's actually better, especially when it's something that can be misconstrued, your tone can be misunderstood. It's probably better just to say, "Oh, that was really funny," like you said, Greg. "Oh, what did you mean by that? What is that? What you believe, and what do you believe about this?" It's a lot easier to start a normal conversation than on a social media post where the response might be, "I was just making a joke," or "I was just doing this. Why are you bringing up all of this?"
You know, I was just doing an online instruction and tactics. Excuse me, in the interaction afterwards, one of the students raised his hand and talked about how he used Columbo 1, what do you mean by that, with a woman who's wearing a cross trying to get more clarification on her own view. And he was a little disappointed because he couldn't go beyond that. And I told him, "I'm just so proud of you that you just stepped into the shallow end of the pool. There's nothing wrong. You don't have to go the distance. This is a big point of the gardening. You sometimes it's just very little that you do, or you're not even sure if the gardening you're doing is effective." But the fact that he kind of broke his silence and asked the first question, "Gee, I see you. That's a nice cross. Does it have any significance to you?" Which was a parallel to a question I asked of a witch of a pentagram, and it's an illustration in the book. And just that he did that, I thought was really, really great. So I encourage people to keep taking just that first step if that's all you can do, or if that's all that the circumstances allow.
Right. There will be opportunities in the future with that person if you have any sort of relationship where it could come up again and you could take it farther. So start by building just little bits at a time. All right. Well, thank you, Sarah and Harmony, for your questions. We really appreciate that. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, listeners, for listening. We wouldn't be doing this if you weren't listening, so we appreciate you, too.
Yes, we would. We just talk for the fun of it. Even when people aren't listening. At least I do. That happens around my home all the time.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Keep sending those questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Holland, Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.